On March 8th and 9th, 2010, Cleveland Right to Life launched the first annual Bringing America Back to Life symposium and exhibition dedicated to the entire spectrum of issues that make up our journey to pave the way to a full understanding of the sanctity of life in our culture. Through prayer, action, voting, and education, we will pave the way to achieve this goal. We know you will be edified and encouraged as you listen to our roster of 12 fine speakers who, with their thoughtful, lively, expert presentations, eloquently defend the right to life.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here. Thank you, Dr. True, for that introduction and for mentioning that I used to be a photographer and that I wrote an article on acorns. That means that I can say some things that are understandable. So I hope that you spoke about a small break and I think there was the undertone that it would be a long talk, but a small break. I hope it won't seem that way so much. Everyone knows that my talk is going to be on the issue, really addressing the question that gentleman, one of the last questions that the gentleman asked Dinesh D'Souza, well, how do you prove that this is a human being? What's the logical argument here? That when does human life begin? When is it a human person? Everyone knows that some people think that abortion is sometimes morally justified, and others think that it is not. But notice that from the media, or in the media, we never hear the reasons why. If a United States senator holds that there should be a single-payer health care system, the people interviewing him will ask, well, why do you hold that? What are your reasons for that? But on the abortion issue, there's never any discussion of reasons. I think that's maybe because they assume that it's just one of those issues that people just happen to fall one way or the other depending upon their emotions. And then it's therefore something that you really can't discuss. Or perhaps they think that it's just a religious issue, and in opposition to abortion is just simply a religious issue, and they also think that religious is just a purely private matter, and so it can't be discussed. Well, that's a mistaken view of the whole debate. Rather, although the position that abortion is wrong is something that Christians can hold on faith, this is also a position that anyone can see. Anyone can see that abortion is morally wrong, no matter what religious faith he has, or even if he has no faith whatsoever. We can show that it is reasonable to accept. I will set out here an argument. And I have a handout sheet here. I forgot about this handout sheet. Now we'll give a map. And that map will give you a summary of the basic argument, the basic logical case for the proposition that a human being, a human person, comes to be at fertilization. The starting point for the argument, and the argument that I've handed out, is something that everyone grants. Everyone grants that you and I are persons. Everyone grants that you and I are subjects of rights. That it would be wrong to kill you, it would be wrong to kill me. The key question for the abortion debate is, why would it be wrong to kill you, and why would it be wrong to kill me? What is it about you, and what is it about me, that would make it wrong to kill us? And whatever that is about you and about me that would make it wrong to kill you and me, is that also present in an unborn human being? Is that also present in a human embryo and a human fetus? Here is the basic argument, the basic case. What I will say is that what it is in you and what it is in me that makes it wrong to kill you and me is the fundamental kind of being that you and I are. Namely, that we are human beings, that we are physical organisms with a rational nature, rational physical organisms, that we have a nature, a rational nature, nature that orients us to develop ourselves to the point at which we reason and make free choices. That's something that is true about the kind of being we are. It's not an accidental attribute. It's not some attribute that inheres in us that's different from us. So the first point on the argument, I have it set out in five steps in that handout sheet, is that you and I are subjects of rights. In other words, what makes us, you and I are subjects of rights in virtue of the fundamental kind of being that we are. That is, you and I are valuable as subjects of rights because of our fundamental nature, as opposed to being subjects of rights in virtue of some attributes that inhere in us and that we acquire sometime after we come to be. Let me elaborate a little bit on that point. There is a difference between the thing that you are, on the one hand, and the attributes or characteristics you have in addition to the thing that you are. The thing that you are is a human being, a rational animal. That is, you are the kind of being that has a rational nature, a nature that orients you to developing yourself to the stage where you will reason and shape your own life by free choices. That's a part of your transcendent, that's the transcendent aspect of you. That's the part of you, your rational nature is the part of you, or is that aspect of you that makes you different from other animals. You and I also have, in addition to the kind of thing that we are, in addition to us, we have various additional attributes such as size, shape, and degree of development. And with respect to these additional attributes, you and I are constantly changing. But throughout all of these changes, you and I continue to be. The thing that we are continues. The crucial point for the abortion debate is that what makes you and I intrinsically valuable is not these additional attributes that we are constantly acquiring or losing. Rather, what makes you and I intrinsically valuable is the thing that you are and the thing that I am. The fundamental kind of being that you are and the fundamental kind of being that I am. Now, if that is true, that means also that you and I are intrinsically valuable as subjects of rights from the moment we come to be. It is not the case that you and I come to be at one time and then become intrinsically valuable as subjects of rights at a later time. That makes sense because I'm not just asserting that. There's a reason for that. Why? If what makes me valuable is what I am, then as soon as you have what I am, which is as soon as I come to be, then you have something intrinsically valuable. Now, the second point is this. So the first point is you and I are intrinsically valuable because of the kind of thing that we are. The second point is that you and I are physical organisms. We are rational beings, yes, but we are physical organisms. We are animals with a rational nature, rational animals. We are not purely spiritual beings or conscious subjects that possess physical organisms. Rather, we are physical organisms, albeit physical organisms of a rational sort. And so, we came to be when these physical organisms came to be. In other words, if what I am is a physical organism, then when this physical organism came to be, that's when I came to be. So that's point number two. I'm going to go back over these points and try to give some evidence or answer some of the objections to them in a moment here. The third point, it's on your handout sheet, the third point in the overall argument is that a human physical organism comes to be at fertilization. Now, of course, there are also identical twins or monozygotic twins that come to be a little bit after conception. In other words, you have a human being comes to be at fertilization, and then I think if there's twinning, if there's an identical twin that occurs, then that splits off later on. Then you have an identical twin, maybe a brother or sister that comes to be afterwards. But still, at fertilization, a human being comes to be. So if you put those three points together, if you and I are intrinsically valuable in virtue of what we are, if what we are physical organisms, and if the physical organism comes to be at fertilization, it follows that, if you put all those three points together, it follows that what is intrinsically valuable, or something that is intrinsically valuable as a subject of rights, came to be at fertilization, or comes to be at fertilization. So that's the basic argument I've set out there, or that's the basic logical case. You don't have to be a Catholic, you don't have to be a Christian to believe that. It helps, you know, because it always helps to have extra light. But it's something that some people who are not Catholic, some people who are not Christian, some people who are not Jewish, some people who are not religious at all, they could see this point. And so in sum, and I'm going to come back and defend some of these points. Number one, you and I are intrinsically valuable as subject of rights. Number two, what we are physical organisms. Number three, the physical organism that we are came to be at conception, at fertilization. Therefore, something that is intrinsically valuable as a subject of rights came to be at conception. That's the basic case. Now, of course, that case is debated. And so I'd like to go back over and provide some of the evidence and answer some of the objections to some of those points. So I'll go back and treat those premises. And I'm going to do that in reverse order, just to make it interesting. No, because I want to end up on the one that's most controversial, the number one. Okay, so I'll start with the premise three, then go to premise two, and then go to premise one. Premise number three, namely that a human physical organism comes to be at fertilization, is really a question of biology or embryology. Let me note that some people have the impression that in the abortion debate there is a conflict between religion and science. Some people seem to think, and sometimes the media presents it as if it were the case that there must be some Catholic or conservative Christian dogma that these human embryos are human beings, and that this idea conflicts with what science says. Somehow, it's often assumed that the reason why we think that embryos and fetuses are human is because it's a Christian dogma that there's a soul, and that the soul begins at conception. The fact of the matter is, however, that science is on our side. It's the pro-abortion side, or at least some people on the pro-abortion side, who are trying to deny that every standard embryology text for the last 50 years has been clearly stating. The fact is that the standard embryology texts all state clearly that in normal cases, the beginning of a distinct human organism, and the only reason why I say normal cases is because there could be a misfire so that you have something like a hydatidiform mole or a teratoma or something like that, which is not a human being. But when fertilization is successful, the embryology texts clearly state, the beginning of a distinct human organism or human individual occurs with the union of the sperm and the ovum. And the union of the sperm and the ovum produces a new organism originally called a zygote. And you can see all of the embryology texts that are used in our medical schools still say this, although there's probably political pressure here being applied, so I'm not sure how long they may try to skirt the issue, not by denying it, but by trying to be as not as clear as they have been. But so far, they still all say this because the evidence indicates this. Now, the evidence is really overwhelming, so I'm just going to give a sketch of this here. In the case of ordinary sexual reproduction, and if I stammer a little bit, excuse me here, I've been talking about these issues for 30 years, but I still get a little embarrassed talking about sperm and ova and that kind of thing. At least I don't have a PowerPoint with the whole female reproductive tract up there, which I sometimes do, and that's really, okay, anyway. You'd think I would wouldn't have a. I grew up in the '60s. I don't know why I have this. That we started all this problems as Dinesh D'Souza indicated. Anyway, in the case of sexual reproduction, in the case of sexual reproduction, the life of an individual human being, the life of a distinct individual human being, begins at fertilization. In normal conception, a sex cell of the father, a sperm, unites with a sex cell of the mother, an ovum. Within the chromosomes of the sex cells are the DNA molecules which constitute the information that guides the development of the new individual brought into being with the union of the sperm and the ovum. When fertilization occurs, the 23 chromosomes of the sperm unite with the 23 chromosomes of the ovum. Now, when the ovum and the sperm unite, they cease to be. So we can never say that, you and I once were sperms or you and I once were ova. The sperm and the ovum cease to be, and their constituents enter into the makeup of a new entity. This new entity is then the embryo or the zygote at the one-cell stage. The human embryo, the product of the union of the sperm and the ovum, begins to grow by the process of cell differentiation. It divides into two cells, then four, then eight, 16, and so forth. Although not all the divisions are synchronous, so that you can get nine and odd numbers sometimes. The embryo gradually develops all of the organs and organ systems necessary for the full functioning of a mature human being. His or her development, and I say his or her because sex is determined from the beginning, is very rapid in the first few weeks. For example, as early as 8 or 10 weeks of gestation, the fetus has a fully formed beating heart, a complete brain, though not all of his or her synaptic connections are complete, nor will they be complete until sometime after birth, and he or she has a recognizably human form. There are three important points, three distinct points, logically distinct points, that should be noted about this human embryo. First, the embryo is a distinct being. The embryo is not a part of the mother or a part of the father. This is clear because she is growing in her own distinct direction. Her growth is internally directed to her own survival and maturation, a distinct end from that of the survival and flourishing of the mother in whose body the new embryo resides. Second, the embryo is human. Obviously, no one really questions that it's human. It is genetic structures characteristic of human beings. Third, and a very important point, is that this new human embryo is a whole human organism, though obviously at an immature stage of development. This is a crucial point because there is human tissue and there are human cells that are human, but are not whole human organisms. They are functionally apart. A human tissue or human cell is only functionally a part of a larger organism. By contrast, the human embryo, from fertilization onward, is fully programmed to actively develop herself to the mature stage of a human being. It is clear that after conception, that is, from the zygote stage onward, the major development of this organism is controlled and directed from within by the multicellular organism herself. Unless deprived of a suitable environment or prevented by violence, this embryo will actively develop herself in her own distinct direction toward the mature stage of a human being. So it is clear that this human embryo is, so far, it's clear that it's a distinct being, it's clear that it's human, it's also clear that it is a multicellular organism identical with the organism that will later be. It is a human organism, a whole human organism, because it has all of the internal resources and the active disposition needed to actively develop herself to the mature stage of a human organism. If we look at a six-week-old infant, a six-week-old infant looks very different from you or me, but it's still a human being. 6-week-old infant, she still is a human being. Why is she a human being? Well, we know that she's a human being because she has all of the internal resources and the active disposition to develop herself to the mature state of a human being. That's why we know she already is a human being. She can't right now do the things that only human beings and other animals can't do. But she has the internal resources to mature, to develop herself to that stage. That is also true of the human, of the unborn human being. So that is some of the evidence indicating that the human physical organism comes to be at fertilization. The union of the sperm and the ovum, they cease to be, their constituents enter into the makeup of a new thing. This new thing has the internal resources and the active disposition to develop itself to the mature stage. It's the same organism throughout, actively developing itself. Right? The same organism that will later be a fetus, that will later be an infant, that will later be a toddler. 16 years later, you have to give it the car keys. Maybe 27 years later, he'll be out on his own. Out of college and get a job, and so forth. Well, maybe sometimes it's a little earlier than that, right? So, that's defense of premise number three. Now, let me go back to defending premise number two. A supporter of abortion or destroying embryos for biomedical research might admit that human embryos or fetuses are human beings, but deny that they are persons. In other words, he might deny number two. He might grant that the human organism comes to be when a human zygote comes to be, but still deny that you and I ever were human embryos. He might claim instead that we are persons, but not human organisms. The argument would be that only persons have basic rights, but human embryos or fetuses, according to this argument, are not persons. They're humans, but not persons. This argument is based on a false premise. It implicitly identifies the human person with a consciousness or with some kind of experiential subject that inhabits or is somehow associated with a body. The truth, however, is that we human persons are a particular kind of physical organism. Proponents of this objection grant that the human organism comes to be at conception, or they can grant that it comes to be at conception, but they claim, nevertheless, that you or I, the human person, comes to be only much later, say, when self-awareness develops. For example, Peter Singer, Ronald Dworkin, and some of the other some philosophers argue that this is a human organism. The human organism comes to be very early on, but then the person does not come to be until much later. But if this organism comes to be, if the human organism comes to be at one time, but the person only comes to be later, if the organism comes to be at one time, but I come to be later, what they're assuming is that I am something different from this organism. That I have an organism or I inhabit an organism. This, however, is not true. We are not consciousnesses that possess or inhabit bodies. Rather, we are living bodily entities. What we are is a particular kind of living organism, a rational animal organism. When I write, for example, it must be the same I, the same substantial being, the same substance, the same thing, that grabs the pen, which is a bodily action, and that thinks out what to say with the pen, which is a conscious, self-aware action. When I speak to you, it must be the same entity, the same agent, that thinks out the words and is self-aware on the one hand, and that mouths the words with his lips on the other hand. I think that's true. Sometimes I kind of get carried away. Okay. It's true. So it is clear that I, the self-conscious subject, perform bodily activities. And so it follows that I am a bodily entity, an animal organism, although an animal organism of a particular type. So what I am is a specific type of physical organism. That is the fundamental kind of thing that I am. So if that's the fundamental kind of thing that I am, it follows that then the question is, well, when did I come to be? The answer is, I came to be when this physical organism came to be. So biology alone doesn't prove the answer. Biology by itself doesn't answer the question of when a human person comes to be. But biology shows that the human organism comes to be. If we add the philosophical point or the common sense point that I am a physical organism, then we get the conclusion that, well, the human person came to be when that physical organism came to be, and embryology shows us that's at fertilization. Now, a second way in which a supporter of abortion or of killing embryos might argue is as follows, and that would be to deny the first premise in the handout sheet that I gave you. He might concede that a human embryo or a human fetus is a human being, yet deny that human beings in the early stages of development are bearers of rights. This objection concedes that you and I once were human embryos, and so proponents of this view do not identify the self or the person with a non-physical consciousness. So this is different from the previous objection. What these proponents, what these philosophers argue, is that only some human beings possess basic rights. They possess basic rights in virtue of some accidental attribute, such as self-consciousness or a presently exercisable capacity for self-consciousness that is acquired, they say, only sometime after the human organism comes to be. So this is the denial of the premise number one. According to this view, you and I are subjects of rights, not in virtue of what we are, but in virtue of certain accidental attributes that inhere in us. And we lived for a time before we began to possess those attributes, and we may also lose those attributes before we die. So, they say, you came to be at one time, but acquired certain mental functions or capacities for mental functions that are the basis for having basic rights only sometime later. I save this for last because this is the most serious objection to the pro-life position. Unlike the last objection, the one I mentioned a moment ago, they admit that you and I once existed in our mother's wombs. They admit that the thing referred to by the word I or the word you is a physical organism. What they deny is that this entity is intrinsically valuable at every stage of its duration. I will mention two problems with this position here. The first problem is that if it were true, it would also follow that human infants are non-persons, and it would be morally permissible to kill infants subject to parental approval. And I think this is important to note here, that in discussions about abortion, I think it's very often the case we should stop and ask, okay, if this argument were correct, would it also apply to infants? I think it's very difficult for a pro-abortion or a pro-choice, so-called pro-choice position to be defended by an argument that would not also apply to infanticide. The infant does not yet actually perform any types of actions that are not performed by kittens or puppies. In other words, what do infants do? They sense. They maybe have some imagination. They breathe. They excrete. They maintain homeostasis. But the kinds of actions they now do, other than growing toward the mature stage of a human, other than that one, the kinds of actions they do are not different from the kinds of actions that kittens and puppies can do. And so if we base the value of the being, if we base the intrinsic value of a thing on what it presently does or what it has the immediately exercisable capacity to do, it would follow that infants do not have any more rights than kittens or puppies. Now, of course, some philosophers, for example, Michael Tooley and Peter Singer, bite the bullet here and say that intentionally killing infants subject to parental approval can be morally right. But most people still see that killing a newborn infant is morally wrong, and that a position that logically leads to condoning infanticide must be mistaken. Moreover, if this were right, if one had to have mental functions or an immediately exercisable capacity for mental functions in order to be a bearer of rights, then it is hard to see why it would be wrong to kill a human being who is in a temporary coma. A human being may be in a temporary coma for several weeks. During that time, he is very much like an embryo or fetus. He does not perform any mental functions. That's what it means to be in a coma. And he lacks the immediately exercisable capacity for any mental functions. But he is a human being. The clearest reason why it is wrong to kill a human being in a coma, in a temporary coma, you have to say temporary because most of these guys would say it's okay to kill them if they're in an irreversible coma. The clearest reason why it's wrong to kill someone in a temporary coma is that he is the same kind of being as you and I. He is an individual possessing a nature that orients him to having self-consciousness and shaping his life by free choices. But this same point is true of the unborn human being. Now, someone might object that the individual who is in a coma is different from an unborn human being. The individual in a coma did have consciousness and self-conscious desires in the past. And so they say, well, that's why he's a person. But suppose I was in a kind of coma where we knew with certainty that, although I would regain consciousness in the future, I would not regain any of the same consciousness. I would not regain any of the memories or mental skills that I had in the past. Would it be okay to kill me then? Of course not. But that would not be because of past consciousness or self-awareness, since all of that consciousness and self-awareness is gone. It would be wrong to kill me because by killing me, one would be depriving me of my whole future fulfillment as a rational being. But that point is also true of killing an unborn human being. One deprives an unborn human being of all of his or her future fulfillment. If we kill someone, we don't deprive them of their past fulfillment, even of their present fulfillment. We deprive them of their future fulfillment. What makes it wrong to kill me in such a situation is not that one would be killing something that is presently conscious or even presently able to be conscious. It is enough if I am identical to the thing that eventually will have rational consciousness in order to have a right to life. So to be a bearer of rights is enough if an entity is constituted in such a way that he or she has an active disposition to develop herself toward acquiring to the stage in which he or she shapes his or her life by free choices. So unborn human beings are the same kinds of being as you or I. And so the argument that I have set out there, I think, goes through. The issue at stake in the abortion debate is basically, and this is why I end on this, on that defense of that, in that number one, is whether we will or will not recognize the fundamental equal dignity possessed by every human being simply in virtue of being a human being. The pro-abortion position is in fact a denial of one of the most basic principles central to our civilization, namely that all human beings, irrespective of inessential differences, possess an equal fundamental dignity. And no class of human beings can with justice enslave, use, experiment on, or deliberately kill other innocent human beings for their own purposes. This principle was at stake in the 19th century with the issue of slavery. This is this principle that is at stake in the central debate of our time's abortion. Slavery is profoundly wrong because it is intrinsically unjust to relegate a whole class of human beings, black human beings, to another class, to the status of mere things for use. It is inherently unjust to deny the personhood the equal fundamental dignity of black human beings for the benefit of another class of human beings. By the same token, it is inherently and intrinsically unjust to relegate the whole class of unborn human beings to the status of non-persons. It is unjust to reduce unborn human beings to the status of mere inconvenient burdens that could be ripped to pieces, that could be disposed of in a trash can, or dismembered for the sake of their body parts for the benefit of others. Just as all human beings of whatever color deserve equal protection of the law and our protection, so also all human beings, irrespective of their degree of development, deserve equal protection of the law and our protection. Justice demands no less, and the invocation of our Lord to help and to work for the weakest and most fragile, the least of our brethren, demands no less also. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Bringing America Back to Life symposium presentation brought to you by Cleveland Right to Life. Please encourage others to listen to this and the other 11 presentations. We hope you will join us next year in our nationwide effort to bring America back to life. For information about our symposium or for more information about our full set of audio and video products, call 216-661-3000 or visit our website at clevelandrighttolife.org.